Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Heather Clark. Heather earned her bachelor's degree in English literature from Harvard University, similar to the character in her book, and her doctorate in English from Oxford University. Her recent awards include a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Truman Capote Award for Literary Criticism, the Slightly Foxed Prize for Best First Biography, I'm curious about that one, and more. And she's a former visiting scholar at the Oxford Center for Life Writing and the author of Red Comet, The Short Life and Blazing Art of Sylvia Plath. Also, The Grief of Influence, Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, and The Ulster Renaissance, Poetry in Belfast, 1962 to 1972. And the book we're talking about today is a novel called The Scrapbook. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Heather.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
So is this your first novel?
It is, yes. It's my fifth book, but my first fiction, yes.
And what made you decide to make that switch? Because you seem to have a very successful, lauded career in nonfiction. And what made you decide to do this?
Well, I wrote a lot of fiction in my 20s. I also wrote a lot of poetry in my 20s. And then, you know, life got busy. I got an academic job as an English professor. I had to write academic books for tenure. I had kids. I had a crazy commute between New York and Brooklyn and Vermont. And, you know, the fiction almost just felt like a luxury at that very busy time in my life. My kids are a little bit older now. They don't need so much intense care from me, and that has freed up time. So a lot of mothers will understand what I mean when I say that, right? My kids are basically teenagers now. So I was working on Red Comet in 2015 when I saw my grandfather's wartime scrapbook for the first time. My grandmother brought it out after his funeral, the day of his funeral. And I'd sort of heard rumors about this scrapbook, but I'd never seen it. My father also said he'd never seen it before my grandfather's funeral either. So it'd been kind of tucked away, hidden away for decades, because my grandfather was part of an American army unit that helped liberate the Dachau concentration camp. And when he was there, my grandfather took photos. And most GIs didn't have cameras, but he did. And these photos ended up in his wartime scrapbook. So I saw the photos for the first time, horrific photos, right, of Dachau on Liberation Day. And, you know, obviously I was haunted by these. And I wanted to come back to this story, but I didn't feel like I had the right background to write a nonfiction book about it. I am not a World War II historian. I do consider myself a kind of literary historian of sorts. I'm a biographer and a literary critic, but I didn't feel like I had the right background to approach it as a history, a real history. So I went back to my roots in fiction and thought I could tell this story in a novel. And indeed, that's what I did. I wrote most of the book in 2023.
Wow. And how much is the female character you?
Well, you know, I've sort of made my peace with the fact that people are going to think it's me, right? But what I'm interested in, actually, and I almost wrote it as it, I almost want people to think that it's this real memoir, that all of this stuff, I want people to be so immersed in the book that if they think that, it's almost a success. You know, most of it is made up. But I'm very interested to see what happens in this space where biography and fiction collide. I come to this novel as a biographer. My last book was an 1,100-page biography of Sylvia Plath. So I am interested in playing with those genres and kind of mixing them up. And so there are obviously seeds here of real things that happened with my own grandfather and autobiographical scaffolding in terms of Harvard and Groton and Oxford. But it's been really exciting for me to kind of spin fiction on top of those sort of autobiographical foundations, and to tell this story about the war and memory and inheritance, and really a lot of, I think, profound moral questions that I've been wrestling with for almost my entire academic career. Questions about memory and how we represent violence in literature. What is the role of art in the post-war era? I mean, things like that. This novel gave me an opportunity to ask these questions in a kind of different way than I've been asking them before in my nonfiction.
So there's the protagonists are Anna, and this is 1996, and she falls in love with Christoph. So she's about to graduate from Harvard. She falls in love with Christoph, who's a visiting German student. And both of them had grandparents who were in World War II, who participated in World War II. Neither of them know very much about it because neither of their grandfathers talked about it much. And that does seem typical, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, again, this is the part of the book that is, there's a bit of straight biography in the novel. I actually quote my grandfather's words verbatim in the one interview he gave about arriving at Dachau on that day and what it was like. He gave an interview to my aunt. Otherwise, he never talked about it. I never heard him say a word about it. But I quote him in the novel because I didn't want to make those words up. I think a lot of men who went to Germany in the U.S. Army came in, especially those who had a part in liberating the concentration camps, came back and just didn't want to talk about it. I've actually gotten messages from readers, even in the past week. The book has only been out for a little over a week. I'm already getting emails from people saying, my father also helped liberate, Bergen-Belsen or Dachau, and he never, ever talked about it. My grandfather helped. He never talked about it. I think, we think of these soldiers as part of the greatest generation, which they were. I'm not, disputing that epithet. But I also think they brought home wounds from the war that they maybe did not address, or they buried because we'd won the war, right? It was, we were supposed to celebrate.
They were heroes.
They were heroes. And this was not to be discussed, these horrific things they had seen, especially in Germany. So, Yes, exactly. So the historian David Nassau is coming out with a book in October called The Wounded Generation.
Oh.
And it's all about World War II soldiers coming home. And I haven't read the book yet, but I'm very intrigued by that title and a kind of reframing of what these GIs went through.
And
there's definitely a lot about that in the book, PTSD.
And sometimes that trauma gets visited down on the next generations. It didn't sound like that was really the case with your grandfather, that he maybe didn't take it out on his children or his, spouse or something, but some did. And I had an author of a memoir, which the name is evading me right at the moment, who wrote about that and about how that impacted her childhood too. So.
Yeah. I think, in this book, I was I was interested in exploring it more from Christoph's perspective and the German, that sense of intergenerational trauma, right, on that side, having a grandfather who may have committed war crimes. How does that trickle down the generations? I think also for Anna, though, there is, even with her grandfather, who was a quote-unquote hero, right? He wasn't a perpetrator like Christoph's, but even that, you know, there's this legacy of kind of secrecy and silence and trauma, even with the scrapbook, right? And what did he what happened? Part of the novel, she's just trying to figure out where was he and why did he take these photos and what did he go through? And so there's that. She's kind of reckoning too with this intergenerational burden.
So there's a couple of like threads through here that, and you just talked about one, which was Christoph as a German man trying to reckon with Germany's role in what happened and whether he has any guilt, you know, whether he or any responsibility, any you know, how to deal with it and how the German society and culture have dealt with it. So how did you kind of research that?
Well, there's a word for this in the German language with which Christoph tells Anna at one point in the novel. And I don't speak German, so please forgive my pronunciation, but it's a very long word, as words in German often are. That word is Vergangenheitsbewältigung. And the word means coming to terms with the past, and more specifically, coming to terms with the Nazi past. And so, you know, in Germany, this history is a part of their school curriculum. They send school children to concentration camps to learn about what happened during the war. You know, they're very good, I think, now at addressing it. Maybe and this. People might challenge me on this because the AfD is rising in Germany, which is basically like a far right, some say neo-Nazi party. So that maybe is becoming more complicated right now. And also in the mid-90s when the book is set, that reckoning really hadn't happened yet. But I wanted to explore what it means to be a young person 2 generations after the war, dealing with this the weight of history and this relationship too, this kind of heady love affair. What happens to that when it comes up against the weight of history? Anna goes to Germany to visit Christoph several times over the course of a year. She's trying to make this long distance relationship work. And he sort of takes her sightseeing, right, to Heidelberg, Munich, Hamburg, Nuremberg, and they start off having drinking Weissbier in these beautiful, charming squares, but seem to always somehow end up at a place where the history of the war is very present. So they keep kind of almost stumbling into to these
Almost like
to this
poking the
history.
wounds. They're poking the
Yeah.
wounds. Yeah.
Yeah, but almost accidentally, they don't mean
Yeah.
to. You know, they're in Nuremberg for the day. They go to the Dürer Museum. They have a nice lunch, and then all of a sudden, oh well, there's the courthouse where the Nuremberg trials took place. Maybe we should go in. And then they're just completely jolted by all of this. So Christoph is having to confront his history as he takes Anna around to, you know, these sites in Germany, and she's kind of trying to trace her own grandfather's war history. But you know, James Joyce wrote in Ulysses, "History is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake." And I was very inspired by that quote. I used to teach a class on Ulysses, and that quote really stayed with me. And I think that's part of my characters. Like, can we ever awake from the nightmare of history?
And did you come to a conclusion?
Well, my conclusion is that we need to keep reading our history and keep grappling with it and keep and listen to the stories of our grandparents because they have a lot to tell us. They have a lot of wisdom to pass down. You know, look at the scrapbooks. Look at your own family's archive. Don't just throw it away or keep it in the attic. This is really, these are really important historical documents that can shed light on the past. And I think we're kind of living in this post-truth era where people think, oh, history doesn't matter, or people are rewriting history. We all know Holocaust denial is growing. So I just, I just think we need to pay a lot of attention to our national histories, our collective histories, as much as we do our personal histories, right?
Right.
In the long shadow of Freud, we're all kind of obsessed with our childhoods and our parents and how, what about our national histories? What about our collective histories? How do those things shape us? I was interested in those questions in this novel.
Absolutely. So what are you doing with the actual scrapbook? Are you going to donate it to a museum or?
Yes. So we are in the process of donating the Dachau photos to the U.S. Holocaust Museum. And they don't have enough room for the scrapbook, but they want the photos and some of the other things in the scrapbook. But they had to authenticate the photos, right, before they would take them. So that was a very interesting process for me. I learned more about them and where he had been and why his unit was there, because he wasn't in the official liberating unit, which was the 42nd division, the Rainbow Division. He was in the 86th. So I always sort of wondered why was he there? But the Holocaust Museum shed light on that. They were marching with the 42nd for a couple days. And anyway, I didn't want to go down the rabbit hole of spending like 2 years in military archives for this book, because I know myself and I know that I would do that. I am a biographer. Again, I wrote an 1100 page biography of Sylvia Plath. I have that in me, and I almost had to stop myself, to cut myself off. No, this is a novel. You don't need to spend 2 years in military archives. You know, I obviously did a lot of research, but in a way I held back from knowing every last detail of my actual grandfather's story, because I wanted to make some of it up. And indeed I did. The American grandfather character is really made up from scratch in the novel, though he does march to the same places that my grandfather did.
Right.
But in a way, this was like the opposite of biography. I didn't want to know so much about his real story, because I felt that would limit my imagination. So I read a lot of soldier memoirs, and that kind of freed me, I think, to make up this character. So I had a good sense of what life was like for these soldiers in the 86th Division in 1945 in Bavaria. But I know almost nothing about my grandfather's war, and that's sort of by choice. All I know is what I found in the scrapbook.
Would you write a more of a historical account of it if you had the time?
I don't think so. I wanted to kind of use the story as a launching pad for a fictional story in the novel. And again, I'm not a World War II historian, so for me it would just require so much labor. And I'm working on two other biographies under contract right now American women poets. So those I have to turn my attention now to those. My editor had no idea I was writing this novel, and she was really stunned when she got the manuscript.
Oh my.
So, yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Heather Clark, author of The Scrapbook. And I was able to find the previous interview we did about a year ago with Becky Ellis, her memoir Little Avalanches, where she wrote about, growing up as a World War II veteran's daughter and how his horrific trauma, impacted him for the rest of his life and her life as well. So there's this.
I'll have to read that.
Yeah. So the scrapbook really is a very different kind of World War II novel. It's really from we get a lot of, there are a lot of World War II novels. It does seem like an area that, or a subject that we never run out of stories. And
right.
A lot of the, I've had quite a few historical fiction authors who will write a novel based on some aspect of World War II that I'd never heard of. Most people had never heard of, but they find this story. The most recent one was it was set on Martha's Vineyard, and that there were actually German U-boats off of the vineyard, and there were training camps for the U.S. soldiers, and they were training for the invasion, you know, the D-Day invasion there, you know, who knew? Who knew?
Right.
And, you know, of course, a lot of stories about in Europe about different populations that were threatened by, you know, by the Nazis, and how people dealt with it, and the heroes that came out of that. But this is actually quite unique. Your take on it is quite unique.
Thank you. Thank you.
So
a lot of people have said that to me. Yeah.
Being sort of marketed as a World War II story or as something different?
Yeah, it's funny you asked that, because we've had this conversation at Pantheon, what category or subcategories to put this book under. And right now it's under women's fiction, literary fiction, and family life fiction. And I actually said
and to not
them,
historical
hey,
fiction.
And not historical fiction. I said, can we get this under World War II fiction too? Because the whole book is really about the legacy of World War II.
Yeah.
I think there was some back and forth about that and what this book really was. I think it kind of it's hard to pin down into any one genre. It's a bit of historical fiction. It's a bit of romance. It's a bit of literary fiction. It's been on some thriller websites, right? I guess transcends one genre. It's not easy to categorize, is
absolutely
what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And will you write more fiction, do you think?
I would like to. I mean, that sort of depends on whether people want to keep publishing what I write. But yeah, the short answer is yes. I have more ideas, and for me the nonfiction and the fiction feed off of each other. I recently finished my next nonfiction book, which is a group biography of Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, Adrienne Rich, and Maxine Cuman in Boston in the late 1950s. All of these American women poets, sort of the year before they were famous, when they all knew each other. They were kicking at the door of fame, as Anne Sexton said. So, you know, that was that's another big book. And that took me 5 years to write. And
wow.
But this novel, it just didn't require the same labor. Biographies are really, really difficult. You know, every sentence has to be true. There are 100 pages of footnotes. I mean, you have to go to so many archives, interview so many people. The novel was more, I didn't have to do any of that kind of more practical, logistical, heavy lifting. But psychologically, it took a heavier toll, because I was immersing myself in stories of World War II and the Holocaust. And, you know, that was, and I went to Dachau, obviously. I went to Berchtesgaden, where my grandfather went. I felt it was really important to go to those places. There's a lot in the novel about how we mediate the war through museums and photographs and movies and novels. And so I wanted to do that for myself. But yeah, I mean, this novel took a kind of heavier psychological toll than the nonfiction.
Mm. So there's a lot of, you bring a lot of your sort of literary criticism background into this novel as well, because Anna and Christoph are both very literate. Very interested in literature. They have a lot of discussions, refer to a lot of different writers. Do you feel like people need to know much about, you know, literature and literary criticism?
No, I don't. And in a way, I don't know that I did this consciously, but a lot of the book is Christoph. I hesitate to use the word teaching because I don't want to sound sexist, but he sort of is. He's sort of teaching her about these writers and German philosophers, specifically German writers and German philosophers and German poets. And some of them have written about the Holocaust, and some have not. And he kind of teaches her about this legacy of German romanticism, and he talks about Goethe and Schiller and these great German poets. And then yet he said, but how did this happen, right? In this country that revered its great poets, its composers, and that we descended into the most inhumane form of barbarism, right? So a lot of it is Christoph kind of just grappling with how did this happen? And he gives her what I thought was a very striking example, a kind of emblem of this paradox, this chilling and paradox. He tells her about Buchenwald, and he said, when the Nazis built Buchenwald, they left the Buchenwald, the concentration camp, they left an oak tree standing. And this oak tree was associated with the German poet Goethe. He used to sit under this tree and compose his poems and think deep thoughts, all of that. So the Nazis left that oak tree standing in the middle of Buchenwald. There's a photo of it. You can Google this. And I just couldn't get over that image. And to me, that was like this almost perfect shorthand for how did this happen in the most quote unquote cultured nation almost on earth? And if it can happen in Germany, it can happen anywhere, right? So Christoph is kind of teaching Anna about this history, and he jokes at one point, he says, I'm giving you a German education, but what he is, because she that makes her think a lot harder about the way her own country has treated African Americans and Native Americans, and that history has was, not
Not
has
rec
not been reckoned with in the
yes.
1990s,
And still has not.
now and still has not, and it's being swept under the rug again, as we know
Yes,
right now. So she's learning from Christoph, and but no, I don't think the reader really has to have any prior knowledge of Adorno or Goethe or Wagner or any of these people who are in the book. It's I want people to learn, and I want readers to kind of wrestle with some of these, I think, very profound moral questions about history and historical conscience and responsibility and intergenerational trauma, and how do are we meant to, how much do we take on, right, as the grandchildren or the great grandchildren, for the sins of our fathers, right? It's
Right.
also a love story. I mean, it's also
A
a
love
kind of
story.
passionate love story on top of all of that.
Yes, and we'll get into that a little bit in a moment. I did want to, you talked about our the US history and how we have failed to really reckon with some of our brutality and inhumanity in the past. And I know there have been times in recent years where there has been a push to negate the idea that the Civil War was about slavery and that it was states' rights, it wasn't slavery, it had nothing to do with, that was not it. And I do have family letters from a soldier in the Civil War, and I'll tell you absolutely 100% for sure, he was fighting that war because of slavery. He was from Iowa. He was an abolitionist, and he was absolutely in that army to free the slaves. So they can say whatever they want, but I have the real evidence.
And I think I think Germany has done an excellent job at confronting the truth of this history. I think better than we've done here in America, and just working it into the school curriculum, especially. I mean, all my German friends went to concentration camps when they were in school. I mean, and that was a very meaningful thing that they did, and as far as I know, they still do that. So.
So, So getting back to the love story, there's that's sort of where more of the plot of the novel is in. And did you know when you started writing where you were going with that? Or did it sort of develop as you wrote?
It developed as I wrote, and in fact, I had a completely different ending the first few drafts, and then I changed it almost at the last minute because I just thought, no, she wouldn't do that. She'd do this. So I almost wanted her to not do what she does, but I just thought she wouldn't. Yeah, it felt my original ending almost felt emotionally dishonest, and I wanted to end the book in a kind of open-ended, ambiguous way. I didn't want to tie it up with a neat bow, and I won't say any more about the ending, but yeah. So I didn't. It kind of went. I kind of made up quite a bit of the story as I went along, and after I went to Germany myself on a research trip, it took off. So, but I wanted to write about the experience of losing yourself, self-abandonment to somebody that maybe you should be a little bit more careful with. But I was very inspired by reading women writers, like particularly Annie Ernaux, and who really chronicles that kind of experience in her novels, like Getting Lost and A Simple Passion and A Girl's Story. So a lot of this book is very much from a woman's point of view. There's a lot in it about heterosexual relationships, gender politics, especially in the 1990s, which were not great. So there are Easter eggs in this book, women writers, and I'll leave the readers to find them. But Erica Jong, Emily Brontë, Sylvia Plath, Virginia Woolf, Kate Chopin—they're in the novel. Because all these women writers have that I've studied over the years have given me courage to write about a woman's inner life. And I wanted there to be this psychological tension in the book. You know, she's sort of in a relationship and in a country that she can't trust. And so I wanted to build that tension of, is Christoph good for her? Is he not good for her? How much is she giving up? How much is she gaining? So all of that is built into the love story. You know, and Christoph has his own demons from growing up in this German society that has not reckoned with the war, and he doesn't really know what his grandfather did, and maybe he doesn't really want to know. But his experience of knowing Anna and being in this sort of fraught relationship, passionate but fraught relationship with Anna, is he opens up a bit more about things. He becomes more vulnerable emotionally, and one of the questions is, is that too much? You know, is he going to close himself off again? Did he give away too much? Is he going to look, or is he going to look away?
Heather, do you want to read a little bit from the scrapbook for us?
Sure. So most of the scrapbook is told in the first person, from Anna O'Brien's perspective. There are a few chapters written from the grandfather's perspectives in the third person. I wanted to challenge myself to write in a male voice, write as a soldier. But I think I'll read from just the first page. I'll read, was it? It was about a 5 to 6 minute excerpt.
Sure.
Was that okay? Is that too long? Or, okay.
Nope, that's great.
Okay. So yeah, I think it's maybe about 6 minutes. But I'll read from the very first page, very first few pages of the scrapbook. I crossed borders for him to Germany. I knew nothing of the country then. We met in Cambridge, a Harvard party. The details are not important. What matters is that he was not like the others, and I knew this from the beginning. For years after, I tried to tell myself that what happened between us was hardly worth remembering. Others told me the same. But now I write the truth. He was everything to me then. Everything. My roommates did not like him. They ignored him the week he stayed. You barely know him, they said, and already you're in love. But they were wrong. I fell in love later. During that week, Christoph and I sat together by the window. We listened to music. My roommates came in and out of our suite, said quick hellos, and were gone. They don't like me, he said. It's because I'm German. We were in bed in my small corner room. There was a large window that looked out onto the courtyard. It was the end of spring term, the end of my senior year. Moonlight cut across my bed and illuminated our bodies like ghosts. Probably, I said. I don't care, he said, and then, after a silence, but they should not judge. He stayed with me the week before my final exams, the week I was supposed to be studying. I gave him novels to read. Together we listened to Rachmaninoff, Stravinsky. When we talked mostly about music, how Bernstein conducted Beethoven's Ninth Symphony before the dismantled Berlin Wall to celebrate Germany's reunification, how Shostakovich subverted Stalin's demands, how Stalin could not tell the difference between patriotic music and music that mocked patriotism. Mm. Maybe young men like Christoph existed somewhere at Harvard. Probably they did, but I never found them. I was a rower and lived half my life at the boathouse. The other half I lived at the library. I was shy and rarely spoke up in class. At night, I played in a band. My experience of love was mostly drunk nights on beaches or some rower's dorm room. He came to me the week I was supposed to be studying. I had to pass the English exam to graduate with honors. I had to know everything about all of English literature. We talked about Schopenhauer, Goethe, Joyce, as my roommates wandered in and out of the suite, said quick hellos, and were gone. I knew he was leaving at the end of the week. He would board a plane for Germany on the day of my first exam, and so I could not concentrate. I began to care only about the sound of his voice, the movement of his hands. I forced myself to go to the library. I could hardly bear to be away from him. My world contracted. Only he was real. I lay awake through our last night, committing the contours of his body to memory, studying him. I passed my exams. I graduated. I won an award for my thesis on Yeats and decided I would use the prize money to visit Christoph in Germany. I bought the ticket without asking him. I didn't want his permission. After he left, I read novels by Günter Grass and W.G. Sebald. I only wanted to talk about Germany, history, him. My roommate said I was becoming obsessed. One had lost her extended family at Treblinka. The other's grandfather had survived Buchenwald. I knew little about the Second World War, beyond what I had learned in classrooms, movies, a few books. My own grandfather had helped liberate Dachau as a young GI, but he rarely spoke of it. I had nothing to ground my relationship to the war beyond a Nazi flag he had brought back from Hitler's summer house in the Alps, and his scrapbook, the one with the photos. In the days before I left for Germany, I could not sleep. I stayed awake and thought of Christoph, what it would be like to see him again. Now he knew I was coming. I had called him after my exams and told him, casually, about my plan. I had secured a job teaching English at a summer camp in Switzerland that July. I asked if I could visit him for a few days before I started work there. After all, I said, he wasn't so far away. I could take the train from his place to Lausanne. Would that be all right? Yes, he said, great. He wanted to see me. He would show me his university town where he lived and studied. He would take me to Heidelberg and Munich. He wanted me to meet his roommate, Matthias. He had told him about me, his American girl. My hand, holding the phone, began to tremble. It was strange to think that he too had a roommate, that he was also a student my age, that his life had any parallels to my own. I suppose I had imagined him living a very sure and serious life in Germany, reading Wittgenstein and Goethe. But no, he told me about all-day hangovers and nights spent in muddy fields with the music pulsing through his body to the bodies dancing around him wind and music moving through the trees. It was difficult to imagine him like this, dancing, drinking, standing close to other girls. He had been so sure and serious while he was with me, the week before my exams, the week I was supposed to be studying. We had listened to music, we had talked about the fall of Berlin, the siege of Leningrad, how Shostakovich premiered his 7th symphony in the besieged city, how the German soldiers knew the war was lost when they heard it. And now this voice on the other end of a telephone, a casual, pleasant voice, telling me about raves in moonlit fields. My roommate said, "Don't go." They had both been to Auschwitz. They would never set foot in Germany. But I would go to him. That was the only thing I knew. Each day, they said, "Don't go."
That's Heather Clark reading from the scrapbook. Now, Heather, the book has already gotten a lot of attention, and you were profiled in the New York Times a couple weeks ago. Congratulations. Yes.
Thank you. I'm very grateful for that. Thank you.
And there's something that you said in there that I wanted to ask you about, where you say that she, Anna, puts him, Christoph, on a pedestal, and that's dangerous. Their romantic relationship is a metaphor for a power relationship that has the potential of falling back into totalitarianism and fascism. Was that something that you deliberately set out to do?
No, but it's sort of, it occurred to me because of Sylvia Plath's poem, Daddy, in which she explores these ideas in a kind of wild, campy fantasy. One of the most famous lines from that poem is, "Every woman adores a fascist," which obviously isn't true, but Plath is making these connections between patriarchy and seduction and submission and control and totalitarianism. There's a lot of Nazi imagery in that poem, and it's probably Plath's most famous poem, and that she's making those connections, and I was intrigued by that, and I thought, you know, there is this parallel between falling in love with this magnetic lover, losing yourself to this magnetic lover, and or losing yourself to an authoritarian leader. And what are the similarities there in that experience? Are there any? And I just wanted to explore that, that kind of hypnotism, I suppose you would say. So that, in a way, the love story is meant to, I mean, I hate kind of saying what it should or shouldn't be, but I was conscious of that kind of interesting metaphor. And also I read, after I finished writing the scrapbook, I read Jenny Erpenbeck's book, Kairos. And I was very moved by that book. There's a love affair at the heart of that book, kind of a destructive love affair that I think is a political metaphor for East Germany. But yeah, I think these are interesting questions, right? When we lose ourselves against our better judgments, what happens when we allow ourselves to be seduced?
As you're talking about this and about Sylvia Plath's poem, I just remember a few days ago seeing some reference to some right-wing podcasters and in the U.S. and maybe even some of Trump's nominees referring to him as daddy. Have you seen that?
Yes. And the first time I heard that, around the time of the right before the election, they were saying, you know, daddy needs to come home and give his kids a slap or whatever they said. I couldn't believe it. I just thought, my God, Sylvia Plath, she was so prescient. She predicted this almost, even with the word. I mean, yeah, it was deeply, deeply chilling
yes,
to hear that.
Yeah.
And still is.
Yeah.
And still is.
And I had quite some time ago had read an analysis of sort of the difference between, in our country, it ends up being Republican and Democrat, where one is very much focused on a paternalistic authoritarian family model, whereas the other one is a more nurturing maternal family model. And I think there's so much truth to that.
Yeah. And you know what else disturbed me was the recent call from the government, this suggestion that they would award medals to women who had more than five children. It was five or six children. They award them like this
Isn't that like
motherhood
right
medal.
out of Nazis?
That the Nazis did that. They
Yes.
absolutely did that. They gave literal medals to women who had, I think it was six children and above. Yeah, this is right out of the Nazi playbook. I mean, it's I don't want to be too make you know these I don't want to be too blasé about the comparison, but that is one thing that the Nazis did that this administration is kind of copying. And that, again, deeply chilling.
And of course, the Nazis copied a lot of what the Americans
Us.
had
Yes.
done in terms of racism.
Yes, the
Yeah.
eugenics movement and all of
Yes.
that,
Yeah.
racism. Oh yeah, they learned from us too. So this relationship between Anna and Christoph, it's not just him taking on all of the guilt. She has a lot to bear as well. And they're really wrestling with these legacies. They're not Jewish, but they're wrestling with the legacy of anti-Semitism, and in a way that, I think we all need to try to come to terms with this moment when we lost our humanity, and many moments such, right? White Americans should wrestle with the legacy of slavery, I mean, men should wrestle with the legacy of sexism. It shouldn't all always be on the oppressed to do that work, is what I'm
Yes,
saying. Yeah.
absolutely. There is a poem that sort of weaves throughout the book, Light and Shadow. Can you
Yes.
tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So as I was researching, and I did a lot of research. I have a bibliography in the back of the book of sources for people who are interested. But I came upon the work of the Polish poet, Borowski. He was imprisoned in Auschwitz and Dachau. He survived both of them incredibly. But he wrote very chilling fiction about his time there. He was part of a group that sent Jews to the gas chambers, and that was sort of, I think the idea is that that's how he survived. And his writing about this time is incredibly chilling and bleak and ironic, and he ended up committing suicide after the war. But he wrote a beautiful poem. He wrote a series of beautiful love poems when he was at Dachau and Auschwitz. And as far as I could tell from my research, these are the only love poems to have survived those places. And I wanted to put that into the book because Anna and Christoph talk about Theodor Adorno's famous saying, "It is barbaric to write poetry after Auschwitz." And so this poem takes on a role, and Anna wonders, well, did that save Borowski, writing poetry there? And is Adorno wrong about that? And she sort of romanticizes this poem a bit when maybe she shouldn't. But it injects, I wanted to use that poem to inject this sort of deeper engagement with, how do we write about the Holocaust? How do we approach it in words? Is silence better? Do we not write about it? Well, what happens when we don't write about it? Christoph says at one point, then there is only silence and forgetting. And yet it is so, the stakes are so high when you write about something like the Holocaust.
And how do you
But
not
I
trivialize it?
and how do you not trivialize it, and how do you not sentimentalize it? And I think for me, the way is I have my characters wrestle with that very question in a way that's how I write about it, is putting the question out there and having them debate it. But the poem is quite beautiful, and I mean, I could read it if you
Yes, that
want.
would be lovely.
And this is a translation by Ruth Franklin. into English. I'll just read the poem. It's quite beautiful, and I want more people to read Borowski. I want more people to know about him. I know you are alive. Otherwise, what sense would there be in the shadow and light of faraway cold stars? The black earth seems to blaze with dew. The woods rise up darkly above the horizon, as if it were the sea's blue depths. And my blood pulses as if its beat answered the beat of the waves of all the seas in the universe. So close to me, and yet so far, pulsing with your blood. I feel you are here. I know you are. So Borowski wrote this poem to his fiancée, who was also imprisoned in the concentration camp system. She was sort of moved around, and he lost sight of her. He lost track of her, and he finally found her. I believe it was 2 years after the war, and they married. And now Anna reads this poem, and she thinks, well, maybe poetry saved him. And then Christoph says, he killed himself after the war. So I wanted readers to know that happened to him.
Wow. Now you, a lot of the book is set in Germany, and you write in pretty good, great detail about these different cities that Christoph takes Anna to see. So, and you mentioned that you did research trips, you went there. Was that your first time going to these places?
No, I had visited these places in the late 90s.
Okay.
And that was a very different time. And in fact, I began the scrapbook, what eventually became the scrapbook, in the late 90s. When I was in my 20s, I was very unsettled by what I felt like. I felt like there was a lack of memorials, monuments. It was as if the war had almost never happened, right? I was sitting in these charming German squares with these beautiful German friends, drinking Weissbier, laughing, and the cities had been completely rebuilt. And I knew my grandfather had been there, and so this was always weighing on me, even in my 20s. And it just was a sense of disquiet. I almost titled the book Disquiet. And it just seemed like things were almost being erased, or there was the silence around the war. And that changed in the late 90s, when historians really began to reckon with, especially the atrocities that the regular German army, the Wehrmacht, had committed in the East. But I wanted to set the novel at this kind of liminal time where the war was still this great shadow, but hadn't quite been reckoned with in the way that it's being reckoned with now in Germany. So I had it was actually really interesting for me to go back to this manuscript. I mean, it had been sitting on my computer for, I don't know, 25 years. And I finally opened it again, and it was like this time capsule. And I had almost forgotten about it, right? It had been so long. And then I just thought, oh, I want to go back to this. After I saw my grandfather's scrapbook, it brought me back to that time and place. And I kind of saw a way to connect these two plots. I rewrote the beginning more or less, and I wrote almost all of it in 2023. And yes, I did go back to Germany. I went back to the same places, and with an older and wiser perspective.
So when you first started writing this, you had not seen the scrapbook at that point.
No,
No.
no,
Okay.
no, no.
But
Yeah.
you're still drawn to this to these themes, this idea, and now how did you record the actual physical facts of these locations and your impressions of them to translate them to the page? Did you do it through photographs? Was it just your memory? Did you take notes as you were there? How did you do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, as a researcher, I spend as a biographer, I should say, I spend so much time in archives, just reading letters, reading writers' old manuscripts, piecing together the story through archival documents. This was different. This was much more of kind of almost field work in a way. I went to so many museums and historical sites, and yes, I took notes. I took lots of photographs, kept a journal, and when I got back to America, I wrote the last, third of the book really quickly, based on all of that research. But one thing is it's interesting. I had a lot of trepidation about approaching this subject as a non-Jew, and especially the chapter that's set at Dachau itself. And my editor said to me when she read the first draft, she said, "There's one part where my nonfiction writer is getting in the way of my fiction writer, and that's the Dachau chapter." She said, you just feel like there's no emotional connection here. You're like this professional tour guide leading us through the museum and saying, "Oh, and here is a plaque of this, and here is a photograph of this, and here is a uniform behind a case that a prisoner wore." She said, you need to establish more of an emotional connection with the reader. And I think I was scared to do that because I almost felt like I didn't have the right. And my editor is Jewish and lost a lot of family in the Holocaust and said, you do have the right. You can write about this. And I feel like that was very helpful for me. She almost like gave me permission. So I rewrote that whole chapter and try it with less trepidation, less fear, and she was right. It came out better. I kind of got all of that distance out of it, and I hopefully, I tried to establish that emotional connection with the reader, like what it's like to be at the museum, the memorial site of these camps, decades later. What is it like to have that experience?
Wow. Well, Heather, thank you so much for joining us today with to talk about the scrapbook. It's a really fascinating book to read. It's like I said, it's not like any other World War II novel, and but it really draws you in. And we always close with the quote, and I Googled, quotes on the importance of history. There are so many good quotes on the importance of history, but this is one I found kind of interesting from Aldous Huxley. I don't know if I pronounced his name correctly or not, but that men do not learn very much from the lessons of history is the most important of all the lessons that history has to teach.
Yes. Read history.
Yeah.
Read your history. Yeah.
Well, thank you for being with us, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thanks for having me.